When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Welcome to another podcast. It's FliesOffice.com, brought to you by our friends with the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, also Madison Teachers Incorporated, and Madison Firefighters, Local 311. Joining us now, John Nichols from the Capital Time and Capital Times and the Nation. Quite the interesting story in Madison yesterday, where Judge Richard Neese struck down the extraordinary session and its fruits. Your reaction?
It was a very good decision. I say that in part because of my own sentiments. Beyond any of the legal things we'll talk about in a moment. What happened here was a pushback against a assault by, frankly, bitter and frustrated Republicans who had suffered a severe electoral setback in 2018. They had presumed they were going to win everything. They were quite confident, actually. Or not everything, but a lot of, they thought they were going to win at least quite a few races. They thought that, Scott Walker would pull off the gubernatorial race narrowly. They knew it was a hard race, but they thought they could pull it off. They thought they would reelect Brad Schimmel as attorney general and basically hold some other stuff statewide. Instead, they lost every statewide office. They lost to the Senate, as was likely, but they also lost governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, secretary of state, and state treasurer. A real setback for a party that only a few years ago was being told that they had sort of shifted Wisconsin, that Wisconsin was no longer a competitive state, certainly not a blue state, that it had become a Republican state. And in their bitterness, they, basically decided to rewrite the rules. Everything that they had done in governing, Scott Walker and his allies tried to undo, weaken the governor so that somehow they could cling to an illegitimate power. This is not to deny that they had control of the state legislature. They did, through gerrymandering. But they had lost the governorship, and yet they sought to disempower it. They lost the attorney general's job, sought to disempower it. What they did was an attack on democracy itself. They said, we don't like the results, so we're going to rewrite the rules. So, first and foremost, this was great because of, I would argue, because of what I believe. And I believe that, you have to, some fundamental level, except some decisions by the voters, right? That's how the game works. Now, let's go to the legal part. And the legal part is what's really important here. What the judge did here was something that is too infrequently done when we debate about these issues. And that is go back to the heart of the matter. The heart of the matter is the state constitution and precedent. What is the history of this stuff? And the judge wrote, I really commend the decision to anyone. He wrote a great decision, which is very detailed, which makes a compelling argument that the actions the Republicans took were simply unconstitutional, that they acted in ways that were in direct contravention of the intents of the state constitution and of the precedent, of the history. Now, they will point to some sessions they've done along the way, but at the heart of the matter there is the question of whether those previous sessions should have been done the way that they did. They know they're in trouble, some of our Republican legislative friends. So they have said, this might toss out laws passed in previous sessions of the kind that we did in the late fall of 2018, to which I would answer, okay, that's fine. Any good law, any legitimate law that was passed, you can just come back. You're in session, right? Or you can be in session. You can pass them right now and put them right back on the books. That's not a problem. The problem is that you abused the process in the fall of 2018, after you lost an election, to have a defeated governor, and this is the heart of the matter, a defeated governor, Scott Walker, sign into law changes that would affect the governorship of the guy who beat him.
All right, here
and
is
that is an abuse.
Here is Jeffrey Mandel last night on with Chris Hayes.
Well, Chris, there are a number of lawsuits going on in Wisconsin. Our lawsuit on behalf of the League of Women Voters and a couple of other groups, as well as several individuals, really challenged the procedure by which the legislature started these laws. What you're calling the lame duck session last December, the legislature aptly describes as an extraordinary session. And it's kind of a funny word, but the Wisconsin Constitution limits when and under what circumstances the Wisconsin legislature can meet. Here, the extraordinary session violated those limits. And so we sued, explaining that the procedure that the legislature used was invalid under the state constitution, and therefore everything they did was unenforceable and null.
Oh, I see. So this wasn't like there was some pro forma session they were going to go into anyway. Like Congress, for instance, always has a lame duck session, and sometimes they pass some stuff. This is a session that was called for a specific purpose, and there are rules about how and when, under what conditions you can call it, and your contention is they violated those, and so everything that happened in that session is just null and void.
That's absolutely correct, Chris. Unlike Congress, which meets sort of continuously, here in Wisconsin, the legislature can meet in two and only two circumstances. First, at a time as shall be provided by law, and second, if the governor calls them into special session. No one contends the governor called this session, or who's now the former governor, called this session. So the question was this session at a time that was provided by law? And the answer we believe, and the court resoundingly accepted today, is absolutely not. The legislature's post hoc attempts to say that the law allowed this are really meritless.
All right. So, had Governor Walker called this session, would we be talking about something different right now, John?
I think there's a real possibility of that. And, again, that's why I separated, when you asked me about it, why I separated my response into two parts. What I believe as regards a small D Democrat, someone who believes in democracy, I thought what the legislature did was inappropriate, illegitimate. That's one side. That's politics, right? That's what I think. Then there's the second side, the legal side. That's what Attorney Mandel was talking about, and that's what I was talking about as well. And that is that the Constitution is really quite clear on this. And I think the incredible thing about it is that when it was playing out, some of us, even at that time, talked about some of the illegitimacy of the session. But I don't think it got anywhere near the, kind of the focus that it needed. And now a judge has done the basic work. This is why we have judges fight. it's funny.
Oh, but this is a Dane County judge.
Ah, very good. And so, of course, you might challenge that, right? And I understand those who want to diminish or undermine the judiciary because they don't agree with it, with its rulings, and they're trying to regionalize, say, oh, well, this county we don't like. And frankly, if it really had come out of Milwaukee County, they say, well, it's a Milwaukee County judge, or if it had come out of someplace else. That's politics. That's how it's done. That's how people talk about these things. I recognize that. Read what the judge wrote, because what Judge Neese did was write a ruling based deeply in the Constitution of Wisconsin and the history of Wisconsin, and he has essentially put it forward and said to the courts, and it will be appealed. The Republicans are going to appeal this, of course. But he said to the courts that we'll take this up, okay, you can call me a Dane County judge, you can call me whatever you want. You can, make whatever gripe or whatever you do. Read the ruling, and you tell me how you get to an acceptance of this session when the Constitution of Wisconsin and the precedents are so very clear.
All right, let's talk about the immediate implications and the long-term implications of this. What did this set off yesterday, other than heads exploding?
Yeah, you can actually hear the explosions around the Capitol. And frankly, I think the interesting thing about this slide is because this legal strategy taken by the League of Women Voters and some allies, Bloc, I believe, and some other groups, this legal strategy was not the one that everybody was excited about. There are people looking at other ways in, and there's a lot of lawsuits coming. So I think there were even some Democrats, frankly, who were like surprised that they got such a strong ruling and such a clear message. The immediate reaction, of course, of our Republican friends was, you know, all the things that you might suggest or all the criticism in that. The more interesting reaction was that of Governor Evers. And Governor Evers, who, you know, is just not going to get excited, right? I mean, this is, he's a very calm figure, did, to my mind, a very judicious response. He announced immediately that this is what he had anticipated. He said all along, well, maybe this is why I was so calm, because I believed that this session was wrong. And he had a very, you know, genteel press conference. But he did something that was extremely important, and that is that he embraced the power that had been handed back to him by this ruling, by this temporary, what is a temporary injunction, and it will be, of course, challenged potentially. And his embrace of it was to order Josh Call, the elected attorney general, to withdraw the state of Wisconsin from the, you know, ginned up fake Republican drive, multi-state drive, to try and upend the Affordable Care Act. When I say it's fake, i.e., my argument is that they, you know, they're trying to develop a legal theory for how they can toss out the Affordable Care Act after fighting it forever in Congress, after going all the way up to the Supreme Court. You know, they're still, it's a game that they play. And Brad Schimmel and Scott Walker were more than willing to play that game. Tony Evers and Josh Call ran for the governorship, saying, governorship attorney general, saying they wanted to end that game. They wanted to stop doing the silly legal maneuvers. And they were blocked by the legislature from withdrawal. They were essentially, part of what the legislature passed was barriers. The governor, within really minutes of getting this ruling and review of it, ordered the withdrawal. Call immediately filed the motion to withdraw. And so this is very important, because you have a judge's ruling and you have a practical, doable, smart, immediate response. There's more that the governor can do, but the governor has said, you know, he's going to look at it, he's going to look at, you know, what the threats of appeals are, all the different things. But he did embrace the power on, frankly, what I would argue is the highest profile issue that came out of the attempt to disempower him. So this is a big deal. This has national ramifications, because Wisconsin is now in the process of withdrawing from a lawsuit, their legal initiative that Wisconsin should never have been a part of.
What will this? What will? How will this affect WEDIC? Because that is another area that was attacked, right, during the special session.
Exactly. As a candidate, Tony Evers was quite critical of WEDIC, appropriately so. There's certainly been a lot of calls for getting rid of WEDIC. This is Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, I believe, and taking it back into, you know, clear oversight by the state. The governor now has an ability to exercise some authority. That involves a more complex thing, though, and that is that appointments have been made, people have been put into positions, and it is the question of, do you tell them to leave, right? Or do you tell, you know, do you restructure things based on this ruling? We will see where the governor goes, but the governor now has the power to do that. That is extraordinary, because that affects everything, Sly. That's where we're starting to talk about Foxconn and all sorts of economic development issues. It opens up the possibility of a real breakthrough for transparency, for accountability, for oversight as regards economic development issues, which, frankly, Scott Walker ran in a, you know, ridiculous and almost sort of fiefdom-type way. So it's a big deal. The other place I'd point to is the Board of Regents and appointments to the Board of Regents, because the Republicans used their strategy to try and, you know, get people into certain positions and cut off appointments and cut off possibilities by for Tony Evers. Now things start to open up. Now all sorts of possibilities do. And so I think we're going to, you know, we'll see what happens with appeals. Again, I think that Evers has been judicious in this. He's not simply telling people, yeah, put your stuff in a box and get out, right? He is accepting that there are dozens of people in positions, in part because of things that the Republicans did in this, you know, extraordinary session. Now there are questions about whether some of those people will be removed. In some cases, they may not be. But we now have a situation where the governor has an ability to assert much more authority, not more authority than Scott Walker had, but simply the authority that Scott Walker had as regards some of the biggest profile entities in the state. And again, I would say WEDIC is one of them, Board of Regents another case, and frankly, you know, a number of other positions. Also, I would, one final thing here, really want to emphasize that, and this is somewhat under-discussed, this is a massive restoration of authority for the Attorney General. And the elected Attorney General in Wisconsin, Josh Call, now, if indeed this ruling holds, now will have the full authority that his predecessor had. That's a very big deal.
We'll take a break. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation at SlysOffice.com.
Similar to a well-tuned automobile, a guitar requires the same level of attention to perform at its very best. No matter how expensive your guitar may be, we will treat you and your instrument with the utmost respect. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson. We love guitars.
We're back at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by our friends at Madison Computer Works and also Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson. All right, let's talk a little bit about the president and his continuing efforts to denigrate a man who's been dead for 7 months. Here is Donald Trump the other day at a tank factory in Ohio.
I endorsed him at his request, and I gave him the kind of funeral that he wanted, which as president, I had to approve. I don't care about this. I didn't get thank you. That's okay. We sent him on the way, but I wasn't a fan of John McCain.
You know, I've been meaning to bring this up kind of on a personal note for a long time. I can't tell you the disappointment I have that neither my father or mother thanked me for the funerals that I put on for them when they passed away. I didn't even get a thank you, John.
I was at, you know.
You were at both of them. Yeah.
And they were lovely, by the way. And you did.
But do you think I'd get a thank you from them? No.
You know, and you know what? You didn't even get a thank you for ordering that the locations where the memorials were held open up for it.
Right.
Now, the interesting thing is, I believe that it doesn't appear that you needed a presidential order to do that.
Of course, we are.
He doesn't know.
We are joking, but what a ridiculous. Well, I guess the airplane he was responsible for. But
I understand that. But do you understand that the president here is suggesting that he's sort of the boss of like religious spaces?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
it's kind of interesting.
Well,
I thought we had sort of a little, you know, kind of some issues with that. But
all right, so. He doesn't stop. Here he is yesterday on Fox Business with Maria Bartiromo. Listen to this.
You spent a good portion of your time in Ohio the other day trashing John McCain. Senator John McCain is dead. Why are you doing this?
So it's not a good portion of my time. It's a very small portion. But if you realize about 3 days ago, it came out that his main person gave to the FBI the fake news dossier. It was a fake. It was a fraud. It was paid for by Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. They gave it to John McCain, who gave it to the FBI for very evil purposes. That's not good. And the other thing, he voted against repeal and replace.
But Mr. President, he's dead. He can't punch back. I know you punch back,
no,
but he's dead.
I don't talk about it. People ask me the question. I didn't bring this up. You just brought it up. You asked the question.
Well, you talked about it this week.
You asked me the question. When I went out yesterday to the scrum, they asked me the question. When they asked me the question, I answered the question. But you people bring it up. I don't bring it up.
It's just lying.
I know. It's just like, it was a, how does your Twitter feed fit into that, Mr. President? Look, I mean, there's a pathos in this. I mean, it's we're watching a tragic figure in the form of Donald Trump, a man who is jealous by any measure of the esteem in which John McCain is held, who actually seems to enjoy trying to dismantle or undermine the reputation of a figure who is generally seen by an awful lot of folks as, at the very least, no matter what you think of his politics, no matter what you think of, you know, what he did at different times in his life, as somebody who meets the standards, an awful lot of standards of heroism. And Trump doesn't seem to like that, because I don't think anybody's ever going to call him a hero, or anybody who, you know, isn't Lindsey Graham. And so this is a big deal. But I will, there's one thing I think is important to understand here. I do think that even though Trump is a tragic figure and seems quite desperate and sad in all this, I do think there's an element of political calculation here. And this is an extension of Trump's primary motivation. Trump's primary motivation is to win the next fight. And I think he is increasingly conscious with all of the troubles that he's got, legal troubles, congressional inquiries, all these things, the Mueller report on the verge of release by most accounts. I think he is working very, very hard to, frankly, divide the Republican Party. And I think his intent is to make sure that there are no sort of soft ground in the Republican Party, no sort of people who say, oh, yeah, I'm with John McCain. I think he is trying to make Republicans kind of line up and, you know, talk about these things, talk about, you know, what alternatives in the Republican Party are at this point, because I genuinely believe, and I'll say this strongly, I think he fears a primary challenge. Not a primary challenge in the current moment. The current moment, his Republican approval ratings are quite good. But that come later in this year, that he's going to have a lot of trouble. And so I think he's actually trying to get people in line and trying to, you know, make people, you know, not criticize him, or if they have to, like Lindsey Graham, step up and say a nice line about John McCain, to put it in some kind of context where, at the end of the day, Donald Trump is the boss, that he's the big guy. He can criticize anyone, even an iconic figure.
Isn't it fascinating? The woman that holds John McCain's seat, former military pilot Martha McSally, the silence is deafening.
Yeah, I think she's, you know, you'll hear some stuff from her ultimately. But you see, her problem is this. And this is why I do go to that, these political calculations. Her problem is she's got to run again for that Senate seat, right? And even in Arizona, John McCain's home state, there are deep divisions as regards, you know, where the party is. And again, I think Donald Trump wants these divisions. I think he wants the Republican Party not to be in any sort of unifying or forward-looking mode. I think he wants it centered around him. I think he wants Republican elected officials, you know, centered around him. And I just think that his theory is that he will, you know, be the dominant figure, even in these, you know, really unpleasant and painful ways. He will remain the dominant figure. He will absolutely secure his party's nomination. And then he will seek to unite the party in 2020 by viciously attacking whoever the Democratic nominee is. And so you understand, the way to understand this is a two-step process. Number one, divide the Republican Party make things bitter and difficult, and that internally for the primary process, so that people are excited enough or engaged enough to come vote for him, make sure that they push aside anybody else, demonize anybody who might stand up to him, and then, again, in Trump theory, the inside the Trump head, unite the party once the nomination is secured, not by with some vision or some positive, you know, one nation unifying message, but in vicious assault on whoever the opponent is.
You know who I'd love to see stand up against Donald Trump in a debate? Former Nebraska Senator Bob Kerrey.
You know, any moral voice, right? Anybody who's got an ability to speak strongly. I will tell you this.
But he also, Kerry has the ability to throw a shiv. Did you see what he said this week? He said, look, bone spurs don't go away. If in fact, you had bone spurs, send us the x-rays, Mr. President.
Yeah. And boy, you seem to be, you know, whenever you're heading out to the golf course, you seem to be pretty bouncy there.
Well, I don't know. He's in the cart a lot more than he is walking. He does one of the worst things you can do golfing. He takes the cart onto the green.
Because it's his green. That's the way it works. It's good to be the greenskeeper. This isn't exactly where you were planning to go, so I'll say it very quickly. I really hope that Donald Trump faces a primary challenge from somebody who's really ready to go at him. And I know it's going to be hard, and probably Trump wins his nomination, but so be it. And there is some discussion by Congressman Amash from Michigan, who is, in my opinion, one of the most remarkably principled people in the Republican Party. And Amash is a libertarian Republican who's been willing to stand up to Trump on a host of things. And some people have suggested the prospect of a primary challenge from him, and I think it could be remarkable and very powerful. There's also a suggestion that Governor of Maryland might try a run.
Larry Hogan?
Much more moderate figure. Bill Weld is talking about doing this. But all I'm saying is I hope someone who is solid and strong takes this on, and I hope they take it on, even though I happen to have disagreed with him on many issues, but I've debated him over the years many times. I hope whoever does this, man or woman, in the spirit of Pat Buchanan back in 1992, when Pat Buchanan took on George Herbert Walker Bush in those primaries. Of course it was uphill. Of course it was seen as, you know, almost ridiculous, but Buchanan's challenge really exposed the vulnerabilities of Bush on a host of levels, and I think it was consequential. Even though, again, I wasn't a fan of his policy.
Well, we can go back to 1972 and Congressman Pete McCluskey running against Richard Nixon.
Yeah, that didn't ultimately
it was an honorable run. He is still alive, by the way, and now a Democrat. But ever want to read about a remarkable human being? That guy's amazing.
And a war hero too, right?
Right, yeah. And a war hero,
a Marine,
right?
Or yeah, yeah,
yeah. No, absolutely and remarkable man.
No. But I do think such challenges matter. I think they're consequential. I think they actually show the vibrance and health and hope of a political party. But I do think Trump, I believe most people who analyze Trump are missing this part of the calculus. I think Donald Trump lives in daily fear of in any way offending his most conservative base, his most right-wing base, and by extension then, you know, losing his power within the Republican Party. Because you understand, if he doesn't have a secure Republican nomination, if he doesn't have everybody there focused on him, he's done, right?
One more note, and this is going to be an odd curveball here at the end. We're waiting for the Mueller report, which we may not see for a while. The other day, the media captured Robert Mueller driving to work, pulling into the federal building in the garage. And if you had asked me, what kind of car does Robert Mueller drive? I would have said, Cadillac, Chevy Suburban, Lexus, BMW. The man was driving a Subaru. Now, would you ever have picked Robert Mueller to drive a Subaru, which is the car, which is the car of choice in the Isthmus in Madison, for God's sake? Right.
I don't know. It did change my image of the man. Also, frankly, with all due respect, and I know it's the official way of kind of cloaking who you are or whatever, the baseball cap.
Yeah.
I just don't see it. Don't see it. You know? So that those things, both of those, suggest to me that he was desperately trying to be incognito. Because how better to be incognito than with a Subaru?
A Subaru and a baseball.
Yeah, that's it. No one's going to notice you.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.